Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Cape Up. Derek Black was the golden boy of white nationalism. His father founded the racist website Stormfront. His godfather is David Duke. But things started to change when he enrolled in college. In Rising Out of Hatred, the Awakening of a Former White Nationalist, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Saslow of The Washington Post chronicles Derek Black's transformation from white nationalist leader to outspoken critic of the movement he was born and raised to lead. Hear more about this fascinating story and how it relates to today, right now. Eli Saslow, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, so your book is pretty incredible because it's the story about a young man named Derek Black. Tell us who Derek Black is.
Sure.
Or what actually, who Derek Black was.
Yeah, exactly. I think was is the key word. Derek was raised sort of within the very insular world of the white nationalist movement. His father, Don Black, had been the head of the KKK in the United States for a decade, and then later in his life had started Stormfront, which is sort of the epicenter of racism online. It's the largest, for 20 years, it has been the largest sort of racist website in the world. Derek's godfather was David Duke, probably the most notorious racist politician of modern times, and both of those men raised Derek kind of in their image to take over this movement and to mainstream it. And because Derek was really, really smart, and in that case, I should say, is really smart, and also really ambitious, he invested himself in these ideas that he'd been indoctrinated with, and was disastrously successful. By the time he was 18, 19 years old, he'd been elected to office on the Republican committee in Florida. He had his own daily radio show. He was traveling around the country to these white supremacist conferences, giving speeches about how politics were the way that these people could, quote unquote, take the country back. And Derek did a lot to spread these ideas and grow this movement until later, a little bit later in life, after first going to community college, he went to college. And through the course of three really dramatic years, he slowly kind of realized that not only had he been wrong about everything, but also that he had caused huge and tremendous damage, and had to figure out what to do about that. And the book sort of takes place over those 3 years.
Yes. Okay. Let's not give it away because it is it is an incredible story. So David Duke is Derek's godfather, right?
Right. Yes.
But he's also Derek's mom's first husband.
Yeah, in the very strange, for all the other reasons that it's strange and awful, also an unusual closeness in this white nationalist world, in that Don Black, Derek's father, and David Duke were essentially best friends, are best friends, and also, sort of ran this movement together. When David Duke was the head of the Klan, Don Black, Derek's father, was his number two. They kind of came into this movement together and rose to the top together. At first, David Duke at LSU met a woman who he married and had two daughters with. Then they divorced, and a few years later, she married David Duke's best friend, Don Black. They had a child, and that's Derek. So David Duke was, sort of a presence at Christmas all the time. Derek would go and spend time staying with him in Europe, where David Duke spends a lot of his time. A real unusual closeness. Derek's two half-sisters are David Duke's daughters.
Right. And David Duke is spending his time in, I believe it's Austria, and isn't allowed to travel into Germany, but he does a couple times to go see Derek when he's studying there abroad. Not to be hyperbolic about this, but just in the description of Derek and his life then, Derek was being groomed to be a leader. And I kept sitting there thinking, oh my God, this is sort of like the white nationalist Kennedy family.
Yeah.
Where
I think you're spot on, and I think you know, not only was David Duke grooming him to sort of be his protege, but sort of much scarier and probably more powerful, Derek saw himself the same way. You know, I mean, his goal for his life as a teenager was to lead sort of a white takeover of the country. And, you know, he'd invested himself in that. You know, it was what he spent his time studying and reading about. I think it's also important to note that David Duke and Don Black and Derek's family had decided to remove him from the public schools where he lived because they thought those schools were too diverse. And so Derek was spending almost all of his time either at home, where he would research, you know, not only science and math and things like that, but also white nationalist ideas. Or he was traveling along with his father and David Duke as they would spend weeks at a time going usually through the Deep South to all of these conferences or spending time with their white nationalist friends. And, you know, they said that Derek was, quote unquote, unschooled. They wanted to school him only in these white nationalist ideas.
Now, the thing about Derek and the reason why they invested so much in him was the way he went about espousing the white nationalist idea. He was sort of David Duke 2.0, because as I read your descriptions of Derek, I kept going back to my interview with Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans, and his book and how he wrote about his dealings with David Duke in Louisiana and how David Duke was Trump 1.0. But in this, you know, David Duke was able to get as many votes as he did because he put a smiley face on white supremacy and white nationalism. And of Derek, you write, he never used racist slurs. He didn't advocate for outright violence or breaking the law. His core beliefs were the same as those of most white nationalists, that America would be better off as a whites-only country and that all minorities should eventually be forced to leave. But instead of basing his public arguments on emotion or explicit prejudice, he spoke mostly about what he believed to be the facts of racial science, immigration, and a declining white middle class.
Yeah, and was extraordinarily powerful in doing that. I mean, I think one of Derek's most lasting and damaging impacts on this white nationalist movement is that he convinced his father to scrub Stormfront of all racial slurs, all Nazi insignia. This message board that, you know, still remains extremely explicitly racist no longer traffics in sort of the lowest form of racism. And Derek thought, you know, the way we're going to reach more people is instead of using this kind of language, we need to play to this false but unfortunately very widely spread sense of white grievance that still exists in big parts of this country. And Derek began targeting the message to those people. And so when he ran for office in Florida, he would go around talking not explicitly about being a racist, but would say things like, isn't it too bad that we're starting to have all these signs in Spanish all around us? Shouldn't this really be a country that only speaks English? Don't you think it's too bad that we have all of these immigrants coming here changing the culture of what the country is? Don't you think that the violence in the inner cities is a problem? And isn't that probably because of the kind of people who sometimes live in inner cities? He would traffic in all of these stereotypes. And by doing that, would begin to speak to a lot of white voters who agreed with some of his ideas. I mean, I think the fact for me that lasts in my head more than any other in reporting the book is this idea that still in this country, about a third of white people believe that they experience more discrimination and more prejudice than people of color or Jews. That is wildly, wildly off base by every statistical, historical, factual measure that we have. But the fact that that much grievance exists in parts of white America means that these messages have real currency in parts of the country. And Derek was one of the people who figured that out.
Well, to that point, you mentioned earlier that Derek had a radio show on, you know, through Stormfront that was very, very popular. And you write about Derek's philosophy then that white nationalists were not fighting against minority rights, but fighting for rights of their own. Derek and other activists were, quote, simply trying to protect and preserve an endangered heritage and culture, he said. They were trying to save whites from an, quote, inevitable genocide by mass immigration and forced assimilation. What's happening right now is a genocide of our people, plain and simple, Derek said. We are Europeans. We have a right to exist. We will not be replaced in our own country, which has echoes of Charlottesville. But then there is one more thing that you wrote about in your book, and it's quoting Derek from his radio show. I believe it's in 2008. And this gets to your point about white grievance going into electoral politics. He said on that show, most white people don't want to be called racist, but they do want to make sure their culture and their position in society isn't going to be undermined. People are just waiting for white candidates to come along who are brave enough to talk about these things. And when that happens, whites will go streaming to the polls.
Yep. Yeah. Pretty powerful and pretty prescient, I would say. I think one of the things that you mentioned in there also was this idea of white genocide, which has become probably the most powerful keyword within the white nationalist movement. And it's something that Derek did more than almost anyone to help popularize. And when he first suggested it, you know, a lot of people in this movement thought it was a weird idea. Like, why are we going to talk about this idea that that whites are going to be wiped out? How is this really a genocide? How is that powerful? But Derek sort of decided that, you know, if we can convince people that the way the demographics are changing in this country is going to wipe them out, is going to wipe their children out, is going to mean that their people, quote unquote, don't have a future, then that is something that will activate them. And you know, just recently at the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, I know that Derek was haunted and sick to his stomach to hear that the shooter had walked out of there saying that he had done this because there was a white genocide underway. That term has become exceptionally popular within the movement.
You know, we'll get to Derek's sort of transformation right now. And that starts when he goes to New College in Florida. And he ends up, here's this white nationalist, arrives on campus, and he ends up having this collection of friends who he had spent his entire life denigrating, sort of in the abstract.
Right.
We had Matthew, who is Orthodox Jew, Moshe, Juan, who is the first person he met because I think they got lost trying to find the college.
Right.
Then there was Rose, who's Jewish, and they kind of dated until she found out who he was. Eli, how did people find out who Derek was?
Yeah, I mean, for the first 6 months that Derek was on this campus, he sort of made this really calculated choice to be a white supremacist activist on the radio every day and a regular college student in Sarasota, Florida. New College of Florida is a really liberal school. Derek went because it was the best public school in Florida, which meant that it was the best school he could afford. And, you know, he was really smart and qualified. And also he thought, no matter what the politics of this school is, like, nobody's ever going to impact my thinking. Like, this was the thing that he'd invested his entire future in. So he also realized, though, once he got there, that if everybody on that campus knew who he was, his campus life was likely going to be lonely and miserable. So what he would do is he would wake up really early in the morning, which in college is like, you know, 10 a.m. And he would he would walk far away from the dorms to this quiet spot on campus, and he would call into his daily radio show, which he at that point was doing with his father, and they would, you know, go on the air and rail against the minority takeover and say really hurtful things about IQ differentials, spreading this false science. And then he would walk back onto campus and he would sort of befriend whoever walked by. And part of that is that Derek had always been hugely curious about things and about people. And also, he had never in his life been interpersonally hateful, in that he didn't believe that it was ever useful to have like a direct interaction with somebody where you were name calling or things like that. And he tried to make these ideas that he'd been given and learned from very on in childhood, he tried to make them about science and he tried to depersonalize them. So in his personal relationships, he was always kind, you know, a little bit opaque. Nobody knew much about him or his family. And he was just sort of an anonymous kid on this college campus until late in his freshman year there. Another student on campus was doing a paper for the for their thesis on the biggest extremists in the country, and went on the Southern Poverty Law Center website and looked at their their sort of roll call of the people who were the most dangerous to the country's future. And in this list, saw a photo of a kid who sat nearby him in math class. And at that point, you know, the school essentially exploded in this uproar of, what do we do? Now we know that sort of the rising star of this racist movement is going to school among us. How do we respond to that?
Now, so I've got the sequencing wrong, because where does the Details magazine profile of him come into play? Because didn't he sort of strategically place it somewhere where he hoped someone would find it before, I think it was Christmas break?
Exactly. Yeah, he did. And this sort of was happening at the same time as this student was researching on the Southern Poverty Law Center website. Derek, you know, this double life was taking a toll on him, especially because he had started to make real friendships with these people, people who often he dehumanized on the radio. And particularly with one woman, Rose, Derek started to date her before realizing she was Jewish. And then was sometimes, you know, spending nights on the college campus with his Jewish girlfriend and then going home the next day to Thanksgiving in West Palm Beach, where David Duke and Don Black would sit at the table talking about how, you know, the Holocaust was a sham. Derek just felt this tension at that point sort of exploding inside him and felt like he needed it to end. But he also didn't have the courage at that point to tell anybody. So he had tried to take one of these big magazine stories about him and put it in the school gym, like on the elliptical machine, hoping that maybe somebody would see it and discover it that way. I think at that point he just felt like he couldn't take it anymore.
Right. You know, he puts the magazine on the elliptical, open a big picture. Someone,
right.
Find me.
Exactly. So, maybe it's a school where not many people were going to the gym. I'm not sure.
Right. So Matthew is the one who starts inviting him to, was it Shabbat dinners every Friday night?
Yes, it was Shabbat dinners. Yeah.
And that was after he had been discovered.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the things that because Derek had some relationships from those first months on campus before people knew who he was, when the campus sort of exploded in this debate about what to do about him, there were some people who felt like they knew him and who also felt like, wait, this can't be right. This seems somehow inconsistent. Like this is somebody I've spent time with. This is somebody I've played guitar with. Can he really believe these things? And pretty quickly at New College, there were two sort of main responses in terms of what to do about Derek. And I think, you know, they were both effective in their own ways. There was one group of students who thought, you know, we need to shut this down. Like we need to either work to get him expelled. We need to sort of make clear that this kind of speech is not okay here, that it's hurtful. And they began a campaign of sort of ostracism, trying to push Derek away from campus. And they were hugely successful. You know, Derek would sometimes get flipped off when he walked across campus. Students who were in classes with him would drop the class and protest. At one point, students organized a school shutdown where they shut down the school for a day and brought in somebody from the Southern Poverty Law Center to talk about white nationalism and the dangers of it. All of these things, you know, had a real impact on Derek. I think for the first time in some ways, he saw through the eyes of his peers, people that he considered in some small way in his in-group, how hurtful and damaging these ideas were, and how much they affected people. He also was isolated more than he had been before on campus, which was practically useful because then when some people like Matthew and some of these other friends began to reach out to him, Derek was in a much more vulnerable position and was much more likely to say yes. So I think both of these effects really, really did some great good in their own way.
And Matthew was very, very patient. There were people who were saying to him, why on earth would you have this guy over for dinner? He hates you. He hates all of us. And yet you're going to sit across from this guy? And one of those people who really didn't like Derek and who used to go to the Friday dinners but decided to, like, sit it out, sit in her room, not partake, was Allison.
Right. Yeah. Allison was Matthew and Moshe's roommate. And when they decided that they were going to invite this, this famous white supremacist over to their dorm for Shabbat dinner, she thought it was a terrible idea. I think she'd been much more in the camp of, we need to make it clear that this kid is not welcome here. So that first dinner, she stayed in her room. She sort of refused to come out of protest. And she did that for several weeks. But Derek kept coming back, and he it wasn't just the first Friday or even a month of Fridays. Month after month, he kept showing up at her dorm room, and she began to see that he was sometimes arriving with a bottle of kosher wine, or, he was nice to people. It was a diverse group of people at the table. And she first realized he didn't seem to be a physical threat. Like, he didn't seem to want to hurt anybody. And then she just got intensely curious. Allison is, now on her way to her psych PhD, and she really always wants to figure out people. And something about Derek to her didn't fit. She couldn't understand how this person who believed that all minorities should be banned from the continent also was capable of having these thoughtful, worldly conversations with a diverse group of people at dinner. And she decided that she wanted to try to figure him out.
So now Allison figures prominently in the second half of the book, because as she's getting to know him, she is really putting the screws to him in, like, sending him studies and articles, and they're having talks and arguments about his views. She was adamant in a way that and arguably more successful than, say, the sort of more passive approach that Matthew took.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that one of the lessons for me in reporting the book is that there are so many ways to go about impacting somebody's thinking. One of the things that I loved about getting to spend so much time with all of these people is that they had really different approaches. I mean, what Matthew decided he was going to do, which I find totally remarkable in and of itself, is that he almost never talked to Derek about white nationalism. Instead, he decided what he wanted to do was just build a relationship with Derek, not build a case against him, just hoping that at some point, Derek would begin to see past his prejudices to the people and to the humanity. And for Matthew and Moshe also, Moshe, who's a Hungarian Jew whose family was essentially wiped out in the Holocaust, to show up at these dinners week after week, even when there was no sign for a long time that Derek's ideas were changing, and even when sometimes they would hear, oh, during the last week, it looks like Derek was back at the Stormfront conference in the woods of Tennessee, the fact that they kept coming to that table, just sort of choosing again and again to believe in kind of the goodness of humanity is stunning to me, that they never had that conversation. Allison, on the flip side, decided that she was going to go about dismantling Derek's ideology, which meant for her that first she wanted to learn about it. So Allison started having conversations with Derek about what really are the things that you believe. Tell me why you believe these things. What's the science that you have to back this up? And at one point, she took the extraordinary act, after sort of befriending Derek, of going with him undercover to one of these white nationalist conferences so that she could sort of marinate in it for herself and hear it for herself.
Yeah, literally marinated. As I was reading that, Eli, I kept thinking, could I, in a million years, put myself in that kind of position where I am in the room filled and surrounded by people who, if they knew my true identity, would, to my mind, tear me limb from limb.
Yep, exactly. I mean, I think Allison, had the privilege in that situation of being white. She could blend in. She knew that people would not necessarily identify her as an outsider immediately. But I think she spent those 2 days, feeling sick to her stomach and repulsed. And she would go during these speeches to the bathroom and just almost like compulsively wash her hands, because she just had this desire to feel clean and to drown out the noise of what was happening in the conference. And I think more sobering to her, even than any of the speeches at the conference, was seeing how this community reacted to Derek. Derek was not just an attendee at these conferences. He was the golden boy. He was the chosen one. And not only was he giving the big speeches and telling people that the way ahead is through politics, but he also was the most popular person in the room. I mean, these were his family members. These were his family friends. For him, it was almost like being the beloved person at a family reunion. And so in between every speech, if she was sitting next to him, all of these people would come over to him and say, "Derek, we're so proud of you. You're doing such important things. Now that you're getting this college degree, you're going to really be able to sort of mainstream these ideas in bigger ways." And so Allison left that conference not only with an understanding of the ideology, but also with a realization of how much Derek would be giving up if he left it. I mean, I think she realized how central he was to that world.
Well, the way she was able to get to him and after having gone to the conference, and just the way it seems that she's wired, she is about facts, hard facts. Here's how I'm going, as you said, dismantle your arguments. And she perceived that, you know, this is the way Derek is. I think the quote I read before, that, you know, instead of basing his public arguments on emotion or explicit prejudice, he based them on what he believed to be facts. So she met him facts for facts. And the thing that I found most fascinating in this time that we're in, where no one, there doesn't seem to be a set of agreed upon facts, was that Allison would bring him a study on genetics or intelligence and IQ tests, and he would read them, do his own research, and sort of internalize what he was getting from her.
I know.
Being more open and accepting.
Yeah, yeah. And also, like, hugely comforting for me in reporting the book. I mean, I think I sensed this before, as we all do. But looking into all of the facts and all of the science, like, it is all on the side of the anti-racist, right? And so Allison knew that her facts and her science was better. And Derek began to trust Allison enough because there was a relationship there. There was first a friendship and then like a becoming a closer and eventually a romantic relationship. He trusted her enough to open up her emails, right? Like, so he said, okay, if she's sending me this, I trust her, I'll read it. Mm-hmm. And then Derek was smart enough to see that, in fact, yes, her science was better. I mean, Derek talked a lot about this idea of IQ differentials between races. Allison herself at that point was administering the IQ test, knew it much better than he did, and was able to send him all kinds of studies showing him why his information was wrong. She was sending him stuff about the ways in which race is a social construct and how it's sort of bonded to emotions from early in life and given to us in those ways. And to New College's credit, Allison also during this time was able to enroll in a class about the science of prejudice and discrimination and the impacts of it. And she used that syllabus. She sort of like weaponized it and would send Derek all of these studies that she was reading in class about not just how he was wrong, but also about how prejudice hurts people in real ways and the health effects for people who suffer discrimination. And those began to have an impact on Derek's thinking.
So in reporting the book, as a reader, I'm sitting there and I'm reading about this guy who, just on paper, I had so many problems with his worldview, and yet in reading about him and just the way he started shifting and changing, I could not help but be charmed by this guy. And that's why I was sort of asking myself, could I sit at dinner with this guy? Part of me thinks that I could.
Yeah.
Part of me would be repulsed. But the more, the could part was the one that was winning out. It's like I actually thought I could be friends with this guy.
Right. That's an incredibly nice thing for you to say in terms of how I just perceive and feel about the book, too, because I think the truth is that Derek, even when he was espousing racist, damaging, awful ideas, was a complicated person, right? And he was part of this was because these were ideas that he had been given in some ways and not come to on his own. And part of it was because he is just like this insatiable curious person. Like he pursued knowledge even as a white supremacist in every way that he could. And that was through reading, through challenging his ideas, through building relationships. I think you're right. Like I'm sure now, obviously, that you'd love sitting down and having dinner with Derek, and you guys would have a lot of your ideas about things would be pretty
similar.
Yeah, well,
now I would.
but even then, I think like he was, that was the thing that's why all of those students kept coming back to these Shabbat dinners, and it was that was a diverse group. It was there was Juan who had immigrated from Peru when he was 10 years old. There were gay students, there were black students, there were white students. It was a diverse table.
There was a transgender student.
There was a transgender student.
It was Rose's friend.
Right, exactly. And Derek, interpersonally was kind to all of them, was curious about their experiences. And so the other thing that Allison did Derek had tried to separate this idea of white nationalism is it's just an ideology. Like it's not a personal thing. It's just a way of thinking about the big movements of the country and the world. And Allison, which of course was a fallacy, a huge fallacy. And Allison would make it personal for him by saying, okay, so what do you think should happen to Juan, to your friend who you spend all this time with, who's part Native American, part Peruvian, part black, what continent does he go to in this great resorting that you want to happen? And what happens to his family? And how does he get to that other continent? And what does that mean for his everybody else in his family? And how does that look? And she sort of forced these ideas to become personal for Derek. And he had increasing trouble answering those questions. He didn't know where they should go.
So let's fast forward. Allison has succeeded in her work in getting Derek through facts and science and credible studies to see that his white nationalist philosophy was not only dangerous but hurtful and wrong. He decides that he is going to renounce everything. And he does it through the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Right. Yeah.
Talk about the significance of that and when he did it and why he did it.
Sure. I mean, I think for a while, Derek sort of came to these realizations, first that he'd been wrong, then that he had done huge amounts of damage. And his first instinct was, I just want to quietly slip away. And as time went on, he realized that was not a possible thing to do. Like he'd left a huge public legacy within this movement, and he had no right to quietly slip away. He had to sort of speak back against it. But he also knew that by doing that, he likely risked ending every connection that he had to the first 23 years of his life. He suspected that his family would not talk to him again. He suspected that every relationship that he'd had up to that point would be severed. So it took him a long time to get up the courage to do it. He went back shortly after graduating from New College to West Palm Beach to help his parents fix some windows at the house. And it happened to be the day that the Trayvon Martin, the verdict had come out. And Derek was driving around with his dad, and he heard his dad saying all of these dehumanizing things about Trayvon Martin. And it made Derek feel sick to his stomach, I think in part because at that point he was so distanced from this ideology that in fact what Derek had been reading were like the op-eds about Trayvon Martin in the New York Times. But more upsetting than hearing his father say these things was Derek realizing he had said all of those similar things about situations like this again and again and again. And he still couldn't figure out how to tell his father how far he'd sort of traveled from this ideology. I mean, their relationship had always been the closest relationship in both of their lives. And Derek knew that it would, he was essentially going to break his dad's heart. So instead, what Derek did is he left the house and he went to a bar nearby, and he sort of finished writing this letter he'd been working on about why white nationalism is wrong and the damage that it causes and the damage that his family was still causing. And he sent it to the Southern Poverty Law Center in part because he felt like that was where it would resonate the loudest. The SPLC, in addition to having a a large audience of anti-racists is also very well read among white supremacists and white nationalists, in part because they identify it as, you know, like sort of their number one enemy. You know, the SPLC had sort of built itself in some ways on something called Klan Watch, which was a publication that really just covered Don Black when he was running the Klan. So it was this very personal renunciation that he knew his family would see, and he also knew a wider audience would see. It landed with a bang.
Yeah, a big bang. It caused him to I think disowned is probably too strong a word, but his mother would never allow him back in the house. His dad, he and his dad, at least at the very beginning, had a very strained relationship, didn't talk to each other. His father actually thought that this was a joke, that this was, you know, sort of the precursor to fake news. He thought that it was some sort of trick.
Yeah, I mean, Don Black, for his whole life, has sort of believed that two things were like the greatest truths. One, he thought that white nationalism was correct, righteous, the thing that he would devote his life to. And number two, he thought that Derek, his son, was the smartest, most capable person that he knew. So suddenly, if Derek was saying that no, white nationalism is wrong, that meant that Don had been wrong about one of those two things. Either he'd been wrong about white nationalism, or he'd been wrong about his son. And suddenly, like, that paradigm no longer fit. So Don came up with all of these tortured ideas to try to make his ideas still square. Like, maybe Derek had somehow been brainwashed by the left in college. Maybe Derek was faking a change to have an easier life going forward. Maybe Derek's email had been hacked into, and somebody else had sent this email. I think for everybody, and it wasn't just Don, like within the white nationalist movement, everybody knew Derek. And so all of these message boards, Stormfront and everything else, lit up with people first talking about, wait, is this true? What happened? And then as the days and then weeks went on, people trying to figure out, you know, where is he? And is there something we can do about this? And so Derek, by that point, had decided to change his name, switch his first and middle name, and had moved across the country to graduate school, not telling anybody where he was going. I mean, I think at that point he thought his best course of action was to essentially disappear and start over. And he expected at that point that he probably would not see most of his family members again. Some of them he hasn't.
You know, before we started the interview, Eli, remember when I was saying there's this one passage in the book that I can't find it, but at some point, probably during the interview, I'm going to find it. I'm going to go, aha.
Yes, I remember.
I found it.
Yes. Good job.
And this is a good segue into sort of fast forwarding to Donald Trump. You have here on page 252, I think Chloe, you have here, Chloe told Dom that the spectacle reminded her of Duke's rallies in the 1980s when he routinely drew thousands of whites to hear him speak in rural Louisiana. This is Chloe having gone to a Trump rally.
Right. And Chloe is Derek's mom.
Right. And so you have, quote, we have been trying to recruit these same disaffected whites that Trump is going after. It's the exact same audience, Don said shortly after Trump secured the Republican nomination in the late spring of 2016. Quote, everybody may not want to call themselves a white nationalist. That sounds a little scary, but it's the same principle. He is tapping into the fact that race is still a huge part of identity. He's accelerating the timeline of our movement by several decades by making many millions of people more racially aware. Before, nobody really knew what a white nationalist was. Now he's given us this incredible platform.
Yep. Yeah. I think Derek, you know, Derek at first, when he moved away and he moved to Michigan and changed his name, he thought for a while, like maybe all these seeds that he'd helped plant would just stay in the ground, and maybe he could sort of go on and live a normal life, and white nationalism would remain sort of a small thing that not very many people talked about. But he began to see in 2015, 2016, you know, all of these seeds growing all around him, and it terrified him. You know, and this is also when I first learned about Derek and kind of came into his life was after Dylann Roof had murdered 10 people at the church in Charleston and had been motivated by Stormfront and had used language that echoed a lot of the language that Derek and his father would use on the radio. And so not only had that happened, but in the way that anti-refugee rhetoric was sweeping through Europe, in the way that Americans were talking about immigration or the Black Lives Matter movement, and then certainly in the presidential campaign of 2016, Derek heard all of these talking points from his childhood echoing all around him in these huge, powerful ways. And I think the thing that scared Derek is that he knows the power of this ideology, because it's a power, unfortunately, deeply rooted in America's hugely problematic racial history. And Derek believed that, there was a way to speak to this white grievance that would have huge political ramifications. And once he saw that happening, I think he decided, it wasn't enough to speak up against this ideology once in this letter to the SPLC. He decided and has continued to decide that he needs to continue to invest himself and his own future in speaking up against it. Because, at this moment in particular, I think being silent is almost like being complicit. Like, the stakes are just too high.
Yeah, as he saw all around him, Trump was sort of the mountaintop for the white nationalists. But before Trump came along, you had Andrew Breitbart, Rush Limbaugh, Lou Dobbs, Newt Gingrich, Glenn Beck, Congressman Steve King, who were all in one way or another using white nationalist language to talk about mainstream political ideas. Eli, I can't end this interview without asking. So Derek, we started this conversation with him being a white nationalist. He's now no longer a white nationalist, and very much publicly so. Where is Derek now?
So Derek now is finishing his PhD at the University of Chicago. It's his transformation has sort of impacted his, and the fact that he's just invested himself in fighting back against this has impacted his life in these really interesting ways, where he's, as part of learning that he'd been wrong about white nationalism, Derek initially as a kid and as a teenager had sort of invested himself in this idea of like the Middle Ages as a time of crusading white European warriors fighting for the white race. This is like the iconography of the white nationalist movement. And Derek had invested himself in that version of history. Then he went to college hoping to be a medievalist and began to learn that in fact, none of these European warriors conceived of themselves as white, that concept didn't exist in the same way. And also, at that time, actually, the Islamic world was far ahead of the white world, or the European world, I should say, in many ways. And so Derek has switched his specialty and is now studying the Islamic world has been working to learn Arabic. And I think part of his focus, in terms of his own history work, is trying to get medievalists to acknowledge the sort of true version of a more global history instead of focusing mostly on the rise of Europe. So that's one thing that he's doing. But also he spent last summer as an expert consultant to Facebook, helping them figure out sort of the rise of extremism and polarization online. So I think he's trying to figure out what's the way to have the most impact, and I think it's a challenging question for him probably in the years going forward, in that he, I think he feels really compelled to do as much as he can to push back, because all of the damage that he did, it still is real. It still exists. I think Derek, he doesn't know, how many people were marching in Charlottesville, because they had seen something that he'd said, or because they'd gone to the White Pride website that he built for kids that was visited a million times. I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure it's not zero. And so is Derek. Mm-hmm. And I think he feels like, he needs to do as much as he possibly can to push back against it, because the damage is still real. But at the same time, he's I think a really bright historian who has a great future in his own right. And so figuring out a way to balance those two things, I think is something that he'll continue to work on.
And where's Allison?
So Derek and Allison are together, still together, committed to each other. Allison is she's at a school in Michigan, so she's finishing her PhD program. So they live like 3 hours apart, but they spend, I don't know if it's the bulk of their time together, but they, you know, it's a short enough long distance relationship that they're able to spend much of their time together. And certainly when I was reporting the book, I was spending a lot of time with the two of them together, you know, where they would have weekends together and I would just come and third wheel it and hang around.
I mean, that's the thing about your reporting, even here at The Washington Post, is that you give us a fly on the wall, not even fly on the wall. Sometimes, you know, as you said, third wheel, like, you know, it's like, I know Eli is sitting at that table right now.
Right.
as I'm reading things. Eli, last question. What do you hope people will take away from your book?
You know, I think for me anyway, what I took away is it's an interesting like two really divergent sort of realizations. One of which is that the power of this ideology in America's mainstream is profound, and that unfortunately, I think as the country's demographics continue to shift, playing to this false sense of white grievance is only going to continue to have more potential power. And that's really scary. And I hope that part of the book can in some small way be a little bit of a call to action in terms of what we're up against with some of these ideas that are so deeply rooted in our history. You know, the other thing that I took away and that I hope readers take away is that the possibility for personal transformation is profound. You know, like if the future leader to this movement, who was you know, connected to it in every single way, especially within his family, if he is capable of finding his way out, renouncing his beliefs, and ending up so far on the other side as like a rising in prominence anti-racist activist, that gives me a lot of hope that people who have less further to travel, are also capable of challenging their own ideas and changing. You know, the problem, of course, is that there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people who as Derek would say, don't want to be called racist, but who have ideas that are influenced by race and that are racist at their core. And unless we can force those people to confront some of those ideas in the same way that students on campus force Derek to do that, I think we're in a lot of trouble.
Eli Saslow, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter at The Washington Post and author of Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ. One more thing before we go. The Post has a brand new podcast that I'm excited about, and I want to take a moment to share it with you. Host Martine Powers and Post journalists will bring to life the Post's unparalleled reporting through expert insight and in-depth analysis. It comes out every weekday in the afternoon. Here's the trailer, and then go subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You don't want to miss it.
Every day at The Washington Post, we cover the news. We put out a newspaper, we post articles and photos and videos online 24 hours a day. We produce hundreds of stories documenting what's happening in America and around the world.
The CIA has determined that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, directed the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi.
The number of false and misleading claims he made on the campaign trail the last few weeks is breathtaking.
And there's so much that goes into that final product. Sorry, again, how long was it after we left here that...
7 minutes. I told them, I'm like, they just asked me, and I'm like, no, it won't be a surprise if he gets fired.
I received a call from the White House Press Secretary, Sarah Sanders, and she said, hey, the big guy's going to call you in about 5 minutes.
There are twists and turns in the reporting along the way.
I was in Columbia Heights in Northwest D.C. and found an alley by the bar that I was at and put my computer up on top of one of those green recycling bins and
glamorous.
Took the call from the President of the United States, who was on Air Force One.
So we're doing something new, giving you the reporting, the insight and analysis you expect from The Washington Post in a podcast. from the newsroom of The Washington Post.
Hi, Kevin. This is Gabrielle Kelly at The Washington Post. How are you?
Hey there. It's Sunman from The Post.
Hey, it's Dave Farron from The Post.
This is Post Reports, hosted by me, Martine Powers. Stories about politics.
This is a president who owes money to all these people, and you can't really understand his conflicts of interest until you understand who he owes money to.
But also about the state of the country and the state of the world.
And I think that that is where climate change is starting to come in. It's causing fires to move more rapidly, to spread more rapidly, and also to burn hotter.
And how we come to know the things we know.
That's the sound of Antarctic snow. Healthy snow. Not healthy snow.
Most of all, these are stories that capture the reality of the world inside and outside of Washington, with nuance and unflinching honesty.